Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin another week's worth of programming. In the first hour of the program today, we will be talking about NATO and the relationship between NATO and the United States and between the United States and the various countries that make up NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Alliance. NATO was created after World War II to counter the possibility of a Soviet attack on Europe. And the idea behind the alliance was it was a number of nations, the United States, some of Europe's largest nations, and they got together and said, we're going to join together for the common defense. And we have a principle that says an attack on one of the NATO members will be considered as an attack on all, and we will come to the defense of whoever it is that is attacked. And things went along that way for some time until the end of the Cold War. And at that time, a lot of people asked, well, now that the Cold War is over and we believe that there is no longer the possibility of a Soviet attack or perhaps even a Russian attack on Europe, then does NATO still make sense? Do we still need the alliance? That's one question that we'll be talking about this morning. And then, of course, within recent years, there has been some growing tension between the United States and some of the member states of NATO, particularly France and Germany, surrounding some of the decisions the United States has made. And the major one would be the decision to go into war into Iraq. So we have as our guest this morning Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Schocke. He is National Defense Fellow at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's also visiting lecturer in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security for this academic year. He's an officer in the Air Force, was commissioned in 1983. He has served in six states and also in Norway and Belgium. He's a command pilot with over 2,400 hours in fighter and trainer aircraft. He also was chief of offensive air requirements for the NATO alliance. He's graduate of the Air Force Academy, also has a master's degree in history from University of Colorado and PhD in history from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, and is here in the studio with us this morning. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people just try to be brief so we can keep things moving and get in as many people as possible. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I said, and I'm sure that as people we'll call, at the end of the Cold War, a lot of people were asking, does NATO still make sense? Do we still need this organization? Has it outlived its usefulness? Can it have some sort of new purpose? Does it need to change? Can it change? Now, this many years after the end of the Cold War, are people still asking that question?
Absolutely, they are. That question is in the halls of NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium. Every day that is discussed. What is the relevance of NATO? What is its purpose in the modern world?
Mm-hmm. Well, what sort of answer do people come up with that question now? Because certainly one of the things that has happened is that the member states, I think, have started to define the security issues that concern them slightly more broadly. That is, they've enlarged the frame so that they've been involved in peacekeeping. They were involved in Bosnia. They're now involved in Afghanistan. So in that sense, perhaps they have enlarged their security frame. But I think NATO always did have some non-military functions as well. And it seems that what has happened is that those have also been enhanced, perhaps, since the end of the Cold War.
Absolutely. You're very correct on that. NATO has two elements, its political and military alliance, very well described as you initially discussed. The political element is headquartered in Brussels. The military has two elements, one in Belgium and one in the United States. Allied Command Operations in Europe, commanded by a U.S. four-star, and then Allied Command Transformation, headquartered in Norfolk, Virginia. So that is absolutely correct, political and military dimensions. You discussed what is the relevance of NATO. Let me briefly discuss the period of troubles from about 1989 to 2001. This is when NATO was seeking if you will, a mission, because the Soviet Union was collapsing. The Berlin Wall came down in 1989. Soviet Union quickly disintegrated thereafter into the Confederation. Additionally, Germany reunified, which was truly the signal that the Cold War had ended at that period. And now NATO sought to redefine itself during that 12-year period. Now, things changed considerably in 2001 with the terrorist attack on the United States, and I'll talk about that a little later. But briefly, to discuss what NATO did during that period, you're very much correct. NATO sought to conduct operations in a more non-traditional sense. Typically, they were aligned facing the threat of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. And in the 1990s, they were involved in former Yugoslavia, Bosnia-Herzegovina. This was the first peacekeeping operation in NATO's history. So that's very true. They're just ending a nine-year period of peacekeeping in that region of the world. The highest number of troops there were up to 60,000. So this was a very major NATO operation in the former Yugoslavia. In addition, currently, let's take it through that period. Kosovo, 1999, was another major issue for NATO because NATO actually went to war in that period. This was the first combat operations in the alliance's history during Kosovo in 1999. But currently, what does NATO do? There was a lot of discussion during the 90s of what they call out-of-area operations. Is NATO merely a defensive alliance in Europe, or does it have a more global role? This was a very hot issue during the 1990s, was never resolved. One of the NATO ambassadors stated the out-of-area discussion ended with the collapse of the World Trade Center. At that point, NATO sought to reinvent itself as a more vigorous global force. Now, that discussion has gone on many, many times in the past 3 years. The result of it, though, if we look at simply what has NATO done since then, they've changed their military lineup. They now have a functional command called Allied Command Transformation, which I discussed. Their job is training, and their job is also to increase the military preparedness and forces, the capabilities of the alliance. In addition, NATO has forces in Afghanistan. The International Stabilization Force in Afghanistan has been there under NATO, has a command there in NATO. Up to about 8,000 troops are there. In addition, they have troops alongside United States troops. Now, this is a NATO mission. This is not merely bilateral agreements. There are 8,000 NATO troops in Afghanistan right now. In addition, as you stated, Iraq, NATO has just accepted a role called the NATO Training Implementation Mission in Iraq, and they're also training security forces for the Iraqi government. So NATO is transforming itself. It is changing. There's a very good book that just came out, Lawrence S. Kaplan, NATO Divided, NATO United. And it just came out this year. And Kaplan states that NATO has a tremendous ability to reinvent itself. Every time it faces a crisis, it adapts and changes. It is a little slow for U.S. taste, but by and large, it does reinvent itself. And I think there is a future for NATO along lines with what Kaplan states.
There certainly has been in recent years some policy disputes between the United States and some of the prominent European members of NATO. Britain has pretty much been with the United States, but the French and the Germans have not. How does NATO as an entity go about deciding where military force will be applied? I would imagine that could be a difficult conversation because there are a number of nations that belong and that they may have different sorts of national policies. They must be at least in some respect responding to popular opinion there in their home countries. So how is the decision made to send troops someplace?
Excellent point. Excellent question. It is made by consensus. NATO has 26 nations, most recently expanded, added 7 new nations earlier this year, and NATO operates under unanimous consensus. So the political representatives get together in Brussels, obviously with very clear guidance from the national capitals, and then it is discussed in a body called the North Atlantic Council, the most senior political body within NATO. And then when there is unanimous agreement, NATO moves forward. Obviously, there have been tensions over the years. There have been some huge crises within NATO over the years. But the fact is that this consensus, when it is reached, is extremely, extremely powerful. It makes a political decision, and then it is backed up by military operations to do just that.
Mm-hmm. Is it the case, I assume that is the case, that the biggest contributor to NATO, both in terms of troops and in other resources, is the United States?
That is true. The United States, if we were to compare the United States with the NATO alliance, the other 25 members of NATO, the United States makes up not necessarily the bulk of the troops. Lots of nations have troops. But on the more high-end capability, the precision-guided munitions, things like this, the United States makes the majority of the contribution to NATO. So that is correct. The United States is the military backbone of NATO.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Schocke. He is an officer in the U.S. Air Force. He is National Defense Fellow at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign and is visiting researcher in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security for this academic year. By his academic training, he is interested in military history and strategic studies in the Cold War. We're talking a little bit about NATO this morning, what it is, and particularly about what's the state of relations these days between the United States and the alliance, and the United States and certain key members of the alliance. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone here in locally in Champaign-Urbana to talk with. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Interesting. Yeah. But what about the other? Didn't Baghdad withdraw from CENTO some time ago? And why announce that CETO and CENTO were canceled? Why not just keep them going on a low budget? Thanks. Listen off the air.
Okay, but before you ring away, the caller's gone. So was the question clear?
CETO, Southeast Asia Treaty Organization. I'm not quite sure what the question was. Baghdad withdrew from CENTO. I'm not quite sure where he was going with that. As far as I think perhaps what he was saying is we're decreasing commitments in other alliances, could perhaps NATO follow the same tact? Mm-hmm. I would say no, because NATO is the largest, most credible, most capable military alliance, and I feel that NATO is indeed the foundation of the Western democracies, and I see a future for NATO. I truly feel that the alliance is growing and expanding, and quite frankly, the reason that's important is seven nations sought to join. There are additional 20 lined up in the NATO Partnership for Peace program that are seeking to join the alliance. And these 26 nations that have expanded five different times over the course of over half a century, no nation has ever asked to get out of NATO. So I do see a future for NATO, and I view it as a growing alliance, increasing in importance for the reasons we discussed earlier.
All right. Well, if we didn't quite get at the question, the caller is certainly welcome to call back and follow up. Also, other people who are listening, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Just to pick up on the last point that you made, it's true that since we have had two major expansions of the alliance. In 99, when we added Poland and Slovakia and the Czech Republic, and then just this year, I believe, we added a number of other states, the Baltics. Forgetting?
Very good. We added the three Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Additionally, Slovenia and Slovakia were added, Romania and Bulgaria. Okay. In 1999, it was the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland.
And Poland, okay. Mm-hmm. So we now have a number of states, and what happens is we have pulled in states that used to be in the Soviet sphere, were old members of the Warsaw Pact. Those states, in addition, what those states seem to be interested in is joining with a new unified Europe. Certainly, I think those states would be very interested in joining the EU, which is hard. It's hard also to join NATO, but apparently it's easier to join NATO. And I think that some people made the argument that, well, it may be all well and good that they wanted to join NATO, that what they see is this is kind of a way in the back through the back door to joining the EU. I mean, do these states really have security concerns that are satisfied by NATO, or are they maybe more interested in the non-military aspects of the alliance?
Well, I hope it's the former. I hope it is security reasons. I have no doubt that there are certainly social economic reasons for them joining as well. NATO has very stringent requirements for what is required to join the alliance, and these are laid out in a membership action plan that generally took those nations about 10 years to achieve. This is stable economies, this is clear democratic institutions, and reformation within the military to add a capability to the alliance. I was in the new nations as part of my job. I most recently left the military command within NATO in Europe, Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe. And as part of my job, I went to the new enlargement nations, six of the seven that we mentioned earlier. The day that the Baltic nations were accepted into the alliance, I happened to be out to dinner with the chief of defense, the commander, the most senior general within the Estonian military. Just the day before, they had Russian fighters fly over Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, just as a show of force to show, if you will, their displeasure perhaps with the incoming alliance membership. I was out to dinner that night, and the chief of defense stood up, and with tears in his eyes, he told the NATO representatives, there were about 10 of us there, that this is a quote. He said, "My nation has been under threat for over 1,000 years. We've been invaded from the north, from the east, and from the south. Thank you, NATO, for guaranteeing the survival of my country." Now, that was very touching to me. So I know that he understood the dimension of the physical protection that would be afforded NATO, that, as you described earlier in Article 5, the pledge, as it's called, an attack against one is considered an attack against all. And he clearly understood that.
I would think, though, that other places, you know, Romania, Bulgaria, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the former Czechoslovakia, those places probably would not have those kinds of concerns.
Perhaps that's true. I did not sense that when I was there. I visited all of the countries you mentioned, and I did sense that these nations not only understood the ramifications of the protection afforded by NATO, but they actively sought to contribute to their own defense. These nations worked very hard at reforming their military, at redoing their bases, adding more capabilities, specialized and generalized within their military. So I think they were working very hard, and I think that they take this as something that is interactive. They will contribute, and NATO in turn will contribute on a larger scale to them. Mm-hmm. Now, these are very small countries that you're talking about. For instance, the gross domestic product of the United States is $10.4 trillion. The gross domestic product of Estonia, who recently joined NATO, is $6.3 billion. So, again, these are very, very small countries. But nonetheless, they are all on equal footing. Politically, they all sit at the table. They all have a vote. They all have a say in the defense of the alliance.
Yeah. One of the things that President Bush has talked about is the need to look at where American forces are based throughout the world and perhaps make some changes. And I think that everybody is expecting that in future there won't be as many American troops based in Europe as there are now, because we were set up to fight a war with the Soviet Union. Now we think that the threat is elsewhere. Particularly there, I think there's this concern about the need to be able to rapidly deploy any place. How do Europeans think about this, what seems to be a certain possibility, a certainty that in future there will be fewer American troops at least based in Europe? And does that have any sort of consequence for the alliance?
Yes, it does. Absolutely. A few of the issues as far as U.S. forces decreasing in Europe. At the height of the Cold War, the United States had almost 600,000 troops in Europe. At the beginning of the 1990s, they had 250,000. That dropped over the period, and currently there are about 70,000 troops. So it is on a much smaller scale. They are looking, the United States is withdrawing the forward-based troops from around the world, not just Europe. This is everywhere. We're going to a concept what the Supreme Allied Commander refers to as the lily pad, where there are prepared bases ready for deployments, not merely of U.S. troops, but of NATO troops. They can go to these sites around certainly the fringe of NATO and for the United States around the world to do just what you said, to quickly move in, expand the base with an influx of troops and military capability, and from there deploy and do whatever their mission would be. There is concern in Europe over this. There was concern when the United States had a very large presence. That's a very large footprint, as they say, and it adds a tremendous amount to the local economies, but it also adds some stresses socially. And that's not just Americans. This is true of any foreign presence in another country. So there is concern, but there is also recognition that the world has changed. The United States' position has changed, and they acknowledge that. So it is a dialogue.
Well, we have some other callers. Let's go to Champaign County, line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. One can't sort of separate the whole political environment between the U.S. and Europe and the rest of the world from the argument about NATO. One thing that's always struck me is that many people in this country have always sort of had this very undiplomatic deprecation of European forces in the sense that they can't solve problems. They have no rapid response forces. They're looking into soft power. At the same time, when the U.S. is dissuading the Europeans from going ahead with any independent force, which they are finally doing, to some consternation, I guess, in Washington, it's almost passive-aggressive on the part of these critics. You know, they condemn the Europeans for not being able to respond to such and such, but then dissuade them from having an independent command. This is very impolitic. It's angered people. I don't think most Americans even understand it much. It strikes me as similarly inane as Condoleezza Rice's remark leading up to the Iraq War that we should isolate Russia, ignore Germany and punish France, and now she's our chief diplomat. So that's a little bit far afield, but she's supposed to be the Europe expert. So,
well, she's supposed to be the Soviet expert.
Well, I mean, that we were understanding Soviet Union in terms of the power politics in Europe. I don't think that's a distinction without a whole lot of difference.
Well, you raise a number of interesting points. You want to make some response?
Yes, absolutely. Very good points that you made. The capabilities that you discussed, I saw those firsthand. I was a requirements officer in NATO, so I saw the forces that were committed to the alliance and their readiness rates and their capabilities. What you said, I'll come back to the disparity between the U.S. and Europe. But first of all, for the capabilities, there are certainly very good capabilities in Europe. I think that they've been badly labeled, and I'll discuss that. But France, the United Kingdom, and several of the other countries have military forces on a much smaller scale than the U.S., but extremely capable in all areas that we're looking for. The alliance as a whole does have some challenges as far as transitioning to a more global role. They have problems with airlift, with sea lift, and rapid deployment forces, exactly as you stated. As far as the European defense, this you correctly describe the American ambivalence towards the buildup of European forces. But this is an old issue. The European Defense Community in the early 1950s, the EDC, was the first attempt to form an independent European force that did not associate or did not answer, if you will, to NATO. The multilateral force was another attempt about a decade later. Then in the early 90s, we had the Rapid Reaction Force, and then we had the Euro Corps, and then we had the Maastricht Treaty, and then we had the San Malo Pact in 1998, which sought to have capabilities for autonomous action from NATO, that is, backed by credible military force. And then in 1999, we had a resurgence of the Rapid Reaction Force, which was 50,000 forces for 60 days operations under the United Nations. So again, Europe has made several attempts, all rather unsuccessful, to have an independent military capability from NATO. And the U.S. has been encouraging until the point where they start having a capability, and then we get a little concerned. And I'm saying we from an administration level over the long history of these forces. So there is an attempt by Europe to define themselves independent of NATO. The concern from a U.S. side is that many of these forces are double counted. They're NATO there's a single force, if you will, in the Netherlands that is double counted for the European Union or any European force, but it's also allocated to NATO. So the U.S. concern is what happens if both of these forces, if the EU would truly be independent, What do we do when NATO needs those forces? So that's the concern, the double counting of these forces. Going back to some of the issues you raised over U.S. Concern over lack of capability in Europe, that's most recently displayed in a book from last year, Robert Kagan, K-A-G-A-N, A Paradise and Power. And he describes a, quote, transnational disparity of power, more simply a power gap between the United States and Europe. And he accuses Europe of seeking and gaining free security from the United States. The term he uses is that the United States is from Mars, Europe is from Venus, and the U.S. worries about global security, Europe worries about global warming. Now, I personally think that's very unfair. If you look at the NATO alliance, if you look at the capabilities of the forces, he is comparing Europe to the United States, and that is true in a relative sense. But if you take it to a little broader level and you look at the world as a whole, if you take NATO and add up all the defense budgets, NATO consists of 60% of the world's military budget. Now, the United States makes the largest proportion of this, 43%. But if we take military spending placement in the world of 158 countries around the planet, the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany, Italy, and Turkey are all within the top 8%, and combined, they have, again, almost two-thirds of the military budget of the planet. So NATO as a whole has a tremendous capability. It simply needs to be rechanneled towards more modern tools, if you will. It's not about aligning a bunch of troops and a bunch of tanks on the Fold the Gap. It's now about projecting power, and NATO is seeking to do just this.
Well, I'd like to respond because I think we should be concentrating on peacekeeping forces to a greater extent. I share the general sense that Europe is opting for what they call soft power and diplomacy, and I think the preoccupation with force structure and what you've all rattled off here we're wasting our time on that to a large extent. Clearly, that's not an ascendant analogy. Obviously, force protection and use of space and all of these things are what the war planners in Washington are preoccupied with, and it's, to my mind, extremely wrong-headed. And I'm ambivalent about a European force, but they seem to think they need a separate thing. I think NATO is a dinosaur and ought to be extinct at this point. I think we need to go to other methods of conflict resolution, and clearly even some generals opposed the action in Iraq. So it isn't just those French that we attacked or that attacked NATO or whatever you said earlier in the show. The French attack, I forget what it was exactly. These figures about NATO and the percentage of the weaponry, that all represents the incredible military-industrial complex of the USA more than anything else. And
you raise a number of points, and I have some other callers.
I'll go on and listen to the rest.
How, from your perception, having been there again recently and talked with people in Europe, how do people think about these two potential missions, war making versus peacekeeping, and which of them is more important, and which they should be concentrating on more?
Well, those are very good points he brought up. Soft versus hard power. Soft being defined as persuasion. Hard, military and economic. This is a term used by Joseph Nye in his book Soft Power. Hard power being military and economic power that is wielded, coercion. I think they're both important. I don't mean to in any sense say that peacekeeping isn't important or anything like that. I think what we're looking for is capability to go across the spectrum of conflict from the low end, low threat to the high end, high threat. Defense budgets reflect commitment, but they don't show what type of forces. But if we look at what NATO is doing, NATO is, until just this month, NATO was in Yugoslavia to the tune of 60,000 soldiers, as I said, currently about 7,000, and this was a peacekeeping mission for almost a decade. NATO, as well, is in Afghanistan. They have almost 8,000 troops there currently, and they're providing security in 9 provinces. And the elections that were most recently held, NATO was there guaranteeing security. This was not war fighting. This was maintaining security, peacekeeping. So NATO is actively involved in that. It's more than just the high-end issues that I was discussing earlier. Mm-hmm. Absolutely, NATO does view it important to use hard and soft power.
We're past our midpoint here. We have some other callers. I think I should also introduce again our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Schocke. He is National Defense Fellow at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, visiting researcher in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security for this academic year. He's an officer in the Air Force. He is command pilot with over 2,400 hours in fighter and trainer aircraft. Among other things, he has served as Chief of Offensive Air Requirements for the NATO Alliance. And by his academic training, he is an historian interested in military history and the Cold War, has a PhD in history from the Norwegian University of Science and Technology. He is also a graduate of the U.S. Air Force Academy. We're talking about NATO and the relationship between the United States and the various members of the alliance. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Another caller here in Champaign County next is line number 2. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I have several questions that I wanted to bring up and see how you respond and maybe take off on them. The first, in a way, is a building on the some of what your previous discussion and the last caller. I wonder if you could explore a little bit how much the impetus towards the European independent force is really an aspect of the French foreign policy and general policy attempts at independence, especially independence of America or even an anti-American policies, which really has a long history in French foreign policy, at least dating back to de Gaulle. So that's one thing I'd like to hear you talk a little more about. The second is NATO's role in what we might call fighting terrorism, whether in Europe or Europe in, as a whole rather than just within individual European countries, and specifically terrorism such as what's recently been in the news with in the Netherlands with the violent Islamic extremists who are, in a sense, becoming a significant factor in Dutch internal politics, but also have, what should I say, pan-European connections because you've got similar issues in Italy with Islamic extremists who are violent. You've got the issues in Spain and in France, and in fact you have jihadists, to call them that, with for lack of a better word, who are going from France and other countries to Iraq in order to fight U.S. and fight NATO forces in Iraq and in other places. So I'd like to hear you talk about both of those issues.
All right.
Yeah. Okay, on the first point, the European, independent European force, is France the instigator behind this? In large part, yes. There, over the history of NATO, there have been repeated attempts by France to assert its position, expand its influence, and counter perceived U.S. hegemony. The independent European force is just one method of doing this. And again, we've seen this over the course of over 50 years. Charles de Gaulle, most famously back in 1965, removed the French military from the integrated military structure of the alliance. At this point, the headquarters I was working in was just outside of Paris in Versailles, and it moved up to Mons, Belgium. And the French to this day do not fully participate within the military. They have liaisons, but they are not part of the military process within NATO. So some of that is true. On the second issue, NATO and terrorism, what is NATO seeking to do? And again, this has been hotly discussed over the past 3 years since the World Trade Center collapse. And NATO is seeking to have a proactive and a reactive role towards terrorism. Proactively, there's a tremendous amount of intelligence sharing, and there's a tremendous amount of concern of restructuring forces so that they can be more quickly deployed should anything occur. And they are actively seeking to define themselves as a counterweight to terrorism, which they've repeatedly described, the alliance has repeatedly described as a tremendous threat to NATO and the individual nation states. So I would agree that NATO and terrorism, that is something they're seeking to do, and they are reacting to this. There is, again, discussion every day in the halls at Brussels to figure out how to do this more effectively.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go to Indiana, line number three. Hello. Is there a caller there on line three?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
At the level of Europe is interested in overheating of the atmosphere, and the United States interested in Earth security, I'd look at this thing all as in terms of oil to compromise China and the rest of the world. And I think the terrorist thing is almost a godsend to those kind of people who look at the world that way, because whether it obtains or not, they can always use an excuse they need to go into a country and take care of something. And it's in a sense, the old British way of lily-ponding, I guess. If you could make any comments about that, thank you.
Okay. For the discussion about oil, that's a little beyond the scope of what we're discussing here. I think it's a very important question, but it really is beyond the scope of what NATO is seeking to do. Going back to China, after the election, there was a series of editorials came out. What is the meaning of this election? Will the tensions between the United States and Europe be repaired under the new Bush administration? And the Global Times, the official Communist Party newspaper in Beijing, said in an editorial that a, quote, balanced transnational relationship is good for the world. So China also seeks to have good relations among the NATO members, U.S. and the United States specifically, and they view this as a very good thing. The tensions are bad for the world.
There apparently has been some recently some reaching out through some not through NATO, but perhaps through some other European structures from Europe to some nations in the Pacific, particularly Japan, New Zealand, and Australia. Do you think that it's possible? You know, we talked a little bit earlier about there having been some expansion in NATO on the two levels in 99 and this year, but all of those nations are all European nations. Is there some possibility you think people think that in future the potential membership could be broadened further, maybe not formally as members, but in some other kind of structure that could include other nations that we think of as Pacific nations, like Australia, New Zealand, Japan, others?
I think that is certainly possible. It's up to the member nations to decide this. There already is dialogue going on within NATO and many of these nations. So within a NATO forum, I know that Australia is seeking certain defense-related interaction with the alliance. I know I sat on a panel where Australia and New Zealand were represented. And again, this was a NATO panel meeting in Brussels, but those two countries were there. Argentina as well sits on the Partnership for Peace. So they have representatives from South America in the NATO military headquarters to interact with the alliance. So certainly that is possible as the alliance seeks to reinvent itself. I think that is a possibility that could occur. But again, it's up to the member nations to decide whether this will be opened.
We have about 15 minutes left. We have another caller here, Crystal Lake. Let's go there, line number four. Hello.
The NATO wrongly just does control Europe. For instance, they said it was humanitarian NATO, United States, and another said that then Kosovo Liberation Army said there were humanitarian reasons for going into Yugoslavia specifically Kosovo, and even the Albanians didn't want NATO to go into Kosovo. I think that it's just there to protect whatever interests the United States has in Europe. They're not humanitarian when it comes to Rwanda or Sudan right now even. So I think it's been really just not humanitarian reasons or reasons to help people. It's really just to make business for the munitions industry, and corporations make a lot of money off of war, and they can use up some weapons too, besides whatever other reasons commercially they had for going into Yugoslavia. But NATO does not need to exist. We should get rid of it. We don't have a threat in Russia. We might be trying to have a threat there, but we should stop that. We should let European nations control their own countries. They don't like an invading army, which really, the NATO is really a Western army, a United States army controlling Europe. I think they would do much better protecting themselves and getting along with people than always having us police every country in the world. We go bankrupt. We don't help anybody. It's not humanitarian. It's always for business reasons.
Okay. Well, certainly the caller has raised a number of points. We talked a little bit earlier about, I asked the question about, you know, how is it that NATO decides where troops are going to be deployed? And you said this was a consensus process that everybody had to agree. Now, one wonders, though, because the United States is the biggest player and is often said to be the dominant member, whether they have disproportionate influence. And in recent deployments of NATO troops, when you look at that decision, does it all come into your head that really the United States is in the driver's seat, so to speak?
Well, certainly the U.S. contributes the largest capability to the alliance. I would bring up a couple points from the caller. Talking about Yugoslavia, Bosnia and Herzegovina were initially United Nations operations. 1992, the UN was there. They sought to do this. When they had Srebrenica, when they had several massacres, they realized they were maybe militarily a bit beyond their means, and they asked NATO help. Early, the United States was very hesitant to get involved there, so I disagree that this was a U.S. drive to do that. Secretary of State James Baker famously or infamously said that the United States does not have a dog in that fight. It's Europeans' problem. Europe can solve it. But Europe asked the United States and NATO to go in and assume a peacekeeping role, which they did. It was very contentious within the alliance. The same with Kosovo. There was a tremendous amount of discussion over not merely what to do, but how to do it within the alliance. But politically, it was resolved, and militarily, it ultimately was resolved as well. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think in fairness, isn't it also true, and I don't necessarily think I have to defend that statement about the United States not having a dog in the fight. But isn't it also true at that time, this would have been the time of the first Bush administration, I believe, that the Europeans were very strong in telling the United States that what was going on in the Balkans was none of our business. They said, look, this is Europe. This is our backyard. We'll take care of this. They kind of told us to buzz off.
There was an element of that. We were seeing this early 90s, you're correct. It was the first Bush administration, 92 time frame we're talking. But the Europeans figured out that they did not, although they had the forces, they had the capability, it was very difficult to get them there and support them while they were there. They needed NATO's help, and they asked NATO to take an active role. Now, I must point out that just this month, the European Union is going to take over operations in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So the EU military force is taking control of that area from NATO, and they will assume a peacekeeping role to do the function that NATO's been doing for the past 9 years.
Yeah. I have a couple of times made a reference to the fact that certainly over the past few years around the issue of the American war in Iraq, there has been a lot of tension between the governments of the United States and particularly Germany and France. And Germany and France are key members of the alliance after the United States and Britain. How problematic is it for the alliance that at this point, at least, there's a lot of tension between those governments? And maybe the French are the most vocal, but I'm not sure that the Germans are all that much more happy about recently what the United States has done than the French.
That was an element of contention. This is beyond what I was seeing. Let me simply tell you what I was seeing within the halls of NATO. At the staff officer level, I was seeing a tremendous amount of agreement among the staff officers. There was not heated debate or contention. This was on a much higher level than I was seeing. I would say that the division within the alliance, and it was a bit of a crisis. Certainly, what happened in Iraq caused a tremendous amount of tension within the halls of NATO. But again, there have been previous crises within NATO. 1956, Suez, 62, Berlin, the Cuban Missile Crisis, Cyprus in 1974. So Iraq is in a long list of contentious issues that the alliance has debated, disagreed on, and ultimately came to agreement and patched things up. So I expect that to happen in this case. Mm-hmm. But you're right, it was a real challenge for the alliance during this period.
Do you, apparently, Ed, again, some of these countries have been working to establish some connections with some governments in the Middle East in a political kind of way. What are people saying? Obviously, now we know that the United States has made a large investment. You may disagree with the strategy, but the aim is peace in the Middle East. Britain has said, as far as they were concerned, having some solution, particularly to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, is going to be their number one thing. What possibility is there, do you think, for greater involvement of NATO in the Middle East? Is there, in fact, interest? Do other countries in Europe say that that's something that they think is particularly important and that they would be willing to put resources behind?
Good question. I think there is a role for NATO in the Middle East. The Secretary General has recently come out discussing that, the possibility of an expanded role. As I discussed earlier, NATO Training Implementation Mission Iraq has just recently been stood up. I know several officers that are deploying to the Baghdad area. It's a very small force right now, about 40 officers. It'll expand to be about 10 times that in the very near future as NATO seeks, under the NATO flag, to train Iraqi security forces. So there is a desire to contribute to stability in the Middle East. Now, NATO is just one of many bodies that are seeking peace in the Middle East. You also have the Western European Union, the European Union, Council of Europe, Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. All of these overlapping organizations are seeking stability in the Middle East. So, yes, NATO is just one of many players, and we hope for international cooperation among these bodies. And most recently, the Secretary General of NATO, Mr. Yaptehoop Scheffer, said that he is seeking conditions for out-of-area action within the alliance. And he said that he seeks closer links between international institutions such as the European Union, the United Nations, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe with NATO to help solve these larger issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, is the whole subject of these out-of-area operations, I mean, is that still at all controversial? Is there a lot of difficult discussion that goes on when they're making the decision where it is we go?
Yes, that's a very important topic. There are issues of major importance to the member nations, but how NATO may deploy and what NATO may do once they're there is discussed daily. Again, there has been agreement in Afghanistan and on a smaller level in Iraq, and that is going on, again, daily discussions over these issues, but they're very important. The Secretary General, again, from the same article called Global NATO, this is an article, a speech that was given by the current Secretary General last month, he said that he seeks NATO to be a forum for a, quote, culture of debate where fundamental security issues can be discussed. So he's seeking to discuss these within the halls of NATO.
Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that there are some people who think perhaps that NATO, there's no reason for NATO to exist, not that there aren't concerns that some kind of organization needs to address, but that perhaps they would say that NATO was the wrong one. As far as you can see, you think that not only will NATO continue, but that the United States will continue to be a member?
I think so, and I hope so. The indications I'm seeing are that that is true. The Secretary General, the current Secretary General, in several speeches has discussed challenges and threats that defy borders require broad, comprehensive approaches for the alliance. This is all part of reinventing itself, NATO to respond to these larger threats. And I think NATO is seeking not a merely geographic responsibility, but a functional responsibility to not merely the use of force, but the use of influence around the world. Going back to what NATO could do, and is there a future for NATO? Is has NATO outgrown itself? Are the threats changing that NATO is no longer serving a purpose? I'll quote an author, Professor Lawrence Kaplan, professor emeritus at Kent State, who's director of the NATO EU Center there. He's written 10 books on the topic. His most recent, NATO Divided, NATO United, which came out a couple months ago. And he says, quote, tensions and frictions were built into NATO by virtue of a free association of its component parts. But there is mutual dependence, and this has kept the alliance together in the past and should continue to do so in the future. So the term he uses for NATO is the enduring alliance, and I would concur with that.
Well, there, I think that we will have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Well, thank you very much for stopping by.
Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
Our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Kurt Schocke. He is National Defense Fellow at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. He's visiting researcher in the program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security for this academic year.